Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history. Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the United Nations Climate Talks in Copenhagen. We are entering the final hours here at the conference and we'll give you our assessment of where the talks are a little later in the show. Specifically, we've got an in-depth assessment of where the deforestation talks are and also an update from Frederica Whitehead about the status of various false solutions that are being pushed for insertion into the clean development mechanism, the kind of one of the market-based mechanisms that corporations and governments want to expand here at Copenhagen. But first, award-winning journalist and author George Monbiot is participating in the Parallel People Summit here in Copenhagen, also known as the Klima Forum. And Arthur Gurling caught up with him and asked him whether he thought there was any grounds for optimism in the way the talks have panned out so far.
You know, some countries have done all right. I mean, I have to say the UK government hasn't been at all bad, but the European Union's disappeared off the face of the earth. During the Kyoto talks in 1997, it was the EU which was really pushing it. This time they're nowhere to be seen. What's going on? The real hero of the talks seems to be Lumumba Diaping, the Sudanese delegate, who has really pushed the wealthy nations to pay attention to what the science is saying. And it's pretty ironic that it takes someone from one of the poorest nations on earth to tell the rich nations who commissioned most of the science themselves and have paid for most of the science to tell them what the science actually says.
So do you think that your view of the COP process has changed during this last couple of weeks? Were you more hopeful at the start?
Well, I was never bursting with optimism about it because I knew what the constraints were, not least the fact that hanging over everything is the fact that the US Senate hasn't made a decision yet and is unlikely to make a decision which in any way reflects the gravity of the situation. And until the Senate sings, everything else is a dead letter, really. But I have to say, even my fairly gloomy outlook doesn't match the full scale of the uselessness of those cretins who are so far utterly failing to produce anything resembling a sensible agreement.
Do you think it's time for a whole new political process?
Yeah, I do. And I think one of the things that's very striking to me is how little has changed in 150 years. The faces around the table are different. There's people from many more countries of the world than the old negotiations where the European powers took a map of the world and drew lines across it and divided it up between them. But there's simply no engagement with people outside those national governments. It's just not happening. There's no process by which the people can feed their views into the process. And you know, we've got to move on from this model where national governments who are elected for totally different reasons than the negotiations taking place here assume a mandate to speak on behalf of all the people of the world without any reference to the people of the world. And that is one of the things that has to change. The process is corrupt. It's exclusive. There is a complete wall between those who claim to represent us and the people. And it's hardly surprising, really, that it's produced so far nothing of substance.
Indeed. But do you think that it's very difficult for governments to have any kind of public participation when actually a lot of the policies that they might propose may be very unpopular?
Well, that is definitely one of the problems. And you know, some governments, including the UK's, it has to be said, you know, I'm no champion of the UK government normally, but it is ahead of the people. Unfortunately, you know, you'd like to believe that it's a people pushing the government, but in this case, it's the government pulling the people. And it's saying we are taking a relatively firm position on climate change. It doesn't go far enough, but a relatively good position on climate change because we believe this is the right thing to do and this is what our scientific advisors are telling us we ought to do. but it's not that we don't see that massive groundswell of popular opinion saying these are the climate policies we want, deliver or else we'll boot you out at the next election. That's just not happening, and it's a real shame. You know, we should be seeing hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. This is, after all, the most important meeting that's ever taken place, or it should have been, because it's about the most important issue. It's about the biggest challenge humankind has ever faced. So where is everyone?
Supposing that it does all collapse and nothing good comes out of it, or a very weak deal comes out of it, how do we galvanise civil society and the public to actually gather their energy together and focus on the issue once again? Because isn't there a risk that people will just forget about it and see it all as a complete waste of time after this?
Well, that's a real danger, that once the excitement's over and the red carpets have been rolled up and the cutlery's all been cleared away, then people kind of forget about it and you know, it loses momentum, the talks lose their thrust. And I believe that those people who are really committed to seeing action taken on climate change, we must get much more confrontational. And I want to see a series of big confrontational direct actions, non-violent direct actions across the world against the most carbon-intensive industries, against coal mines, against tar sands, against oil refineries, against the banks and investors making these things happen. We need to see people thrusting this much more into the public mind, and you do that by taking action rather than just by saying things.
Respect indigenous people's rights! Respect indigenous people's rights! Respect indigenous people's rights! Respect indigenous people's rights! No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
That was the Indigenous Caucus there, demonstrating a few days ago about the lack of Indigenous rights in the red text, the deforestation text here at the Climate Talks. Here's Kate Dooley from FERN giving us an update on the ins and outs of where that text is going. It's been going back and forth all week, it seems, and going through lots of twists and turns. And this kind of updates our interview earlier in the week with Bill Barclay from the Rainforest Action Network. So I'm here with Kate Dooley of FERN. Can you tell us who FERN is and what your role there is? And also, I believe you're also representing the ACRA Caucus. Can you tell us about that coalition?
So FERN is a European-based NGO. We're in Belgium and in the UK, and we work on forest issues in EU policy, and particularly issues that affect social justice and environmental justice in developing countries. The ACRA Caucus is a coalition of over 100 NGOs from over 30 countries, including most of the major forested countries. It's a southern-led coalition, so it's a very grassroots caucus of organisations that came together in Accra to campaign around the issue of red and to ensure that any red agreement that happened at the climate talks included rights at its heart. So it was based on a respect of people's rights, the acknowledgement of the need for forest governance and no carbon trading to be part of the Red Deal. I'm speaking on behalf of the ACRA Caucus because most of civil society is now locked out of these talks and can't get in.
So perhaps you could go through the outstanding issues that the ACRA Caucus considers the current red draft to have, and tell us if it's moved forward at all. I think we spoke to Bill Barclay on Monday, talking about the draft text that came out on Friday. Has anything changed?
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes in the text this week. What we saw on Friday was not too much different than what came out of Barcelona. But on Tuesday night, I believe, the Red Working Group went into a session that lasted almost all night. And on Tuesday, there was a text that a lot of NGOs were quite surprised with. They thought it was much better than we were ever going to see out of Red. And it was a little bit hard to believe as to what had been agreed to in that text. On Tuesday night, the working group went back in and they argued almost all night about it. The text came out on Wednesday morning. It was double in length. Every issue that had seemingly been resolved on Tuesday was back in there, and it was seen as a huge step backwards. Throughout Wednesday, they negotiated again and got the text down to something that was at least comprehensible, which it wasn't on Wednesday morning. And things have not really moved much since those issues were resolved on Wednesday. So what is now in the text and going into the final hours of Copenhagen, what the outstanding issues in the text are, they revolve around the fact that there's no longer a global objective for halting deforestation in the text, which we believe is fundamental to frame that RED is about actually halting deforestation. The safeguards language has improved a lot, and the lobbying of NGOs has been really effective on safeguards. We have the recognition of rights in there. We have safeguards for biodiversity and against the conversion of forest to plantations. And the safeguards language is operational, which for a few days of the week, the safeguards was in the preamble, and that was concerning a lot of people. I mean, that was unacceptable for safeguards to be in the preamble. So they've been moved back to the operational part of the text. But what's lacking now, and what a lot of NGOs are focusing on, is there at the moment is no requirement to monitor and report on the safeguards. There is a sentence further on in the agreement asking for the monitoring and reporting of safeguards, but that sentence is currently bracketed. So if that isn't removed, the safeguards are no more than language, and we don't get to see or have any monitoring that they're actually implemented and stuck to.
Okay. Can you just elaborate on what those safeguards are, just to be clear, because that covers a number of items?
The safeguards does cover a number of items. It covers most of the areas that NGOs have been most concerned with. Key ones are that rights are respected, and that now includes language on the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. So it's noting that declaration has been adopted, which is not requiring parties to respect or act in accordance with that declaration, but it has been a long struggle to get the wording of that declaration into the text. The knowledge and rights of Indigenous peoples are respected, and international obligations are taken into account. Again, it's not the strongest language that has been lobbied for, but there is some progress that language is in there. Also included in the safeguards are the actions are consistent with the conservation of natural forests and biological diversity, which is crucial to ensuring that forests aren't converted to plantations under RED. And there's language on that and ecosystem services, as well as other social and environmental benefits. Two final key things that are in the safeguards, which were bracketed earlier in the week and now are unbracketed, are language dealing with the risks of leakage and the risks of non-permanence, that both of those are addressed in the text. Now, again, like I said, all of the safeguard language is just language, and without a requirement to report on it, we're not happy that it has any binding meaning.
All right, it seems like a lot of things are in flux and seem to go back and forward, but there's also a new issue that you've raised, which is the first time I've heard of it, the debate between whether forestry should be considered as part of a national or a subnational process. I'm thinking that would link into the idea we've discussed before on this programme, that you need kind of complete coverage, really, global coverage of forests in order for this to be effective. Otherwise, there'll be leakage, basically. One forest will be protected, but the deforestation will move elsewhere to an unprotected forest. Is that the essence of what's going on there?
Yes, that's exactly right. Essentially, back when Kyoto was being negotiated, there was a strong push to include avoiding deforestation in the Kyoto Agreement, which would have been under the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism. And there was a large NGO campaign to keep forests out of the CDM because it involved a project-based approach, which meant that you just designated a project area of the country where you reduced deforestation, but there was no obligation to report if that deforestation increased elsewhere. So overall, that doesn't reduce emissions at all. RED, or avoided deforestation, was then accepted into the Bali Action Plan because it was presented with the idea of national-level accounting. Now, this means that a country has to reduce deforestation rates across the entire country. So if they increase in one place, this has to be made up for by larger reductions somewhere else. So it takes care of the leakage issue in a national context, but there still are concerns that leakage could happen internationally, which is why in the safeguards there is language on actions to reduce the displacement of emissions. That's the best language we've got on looking at international leakage. Now, throughout the 2 years of red debates, there have been some countries supporting still a subnational approach, although the majority of countries have always said that red needs to be based on national level baselines to have any integrity that overall deforestation rates have been reduced. What we've just seen in the last few days here at Copenhagen is that a few countries, really a small minority of countries, have stood up and said they won't accept any red agreement unless subnational accounting as part of the deal. Now, vast majority of NGOs are really opposed to this. It undermines any integrity from red, and red cannot be any part of responding to climate change based on a project-based approach. The last working group has just met on red. They were still unable to resolve the national versus subnational leakage issue, so this will now go to ministers tomorrow. And if the three issues I've mentioned so far, the national versus subnational, the need for safeguards to be monitored, and the need for there to be an overall objective to halt deforestation, if these issues can't be resolved at the ministerial level, we don't want to see red agreed without those issues being sorted out.
Could you just be clear about who those countries are arguing for the subnational approach?
Colombia, right from the very start, has always put forward the idea of a subnational approach because they don't feel that they can guarantee reducing emissions across all parts of their country. They think in some areas they're really not in control of forest rates and emissions, deforestation rates going up and down. At various times, different other Latin American countries have supported the subnational approach, but they've tended to go in and out, and it's really Colombia and Chile who've more recently been strongly behind it. And what we've seen the last few days in Copenhagen is the US are strongly supporting Colombia on keeping this subnational approach in. And the US conservation NGOs in particular are behind the subnational approach and won't say anything against it. So without the US's support, Colombia wouldn't be able to make such a strong stance on this.
Why are the US NGOs taking that approach?
Well, the subnational approach is effectively what the private sector wants to see. Subnational means you can define a project boundary, you can reduce emissions within that boundary, and then you can receive red carbon credits for the emissions you've reduced. You don't have to account for leakage outside the project, outside what you designate as the project boundary. Now, this is an acceptable level of risk for the private sector that they can handle. If they had to be involved in national baselines and in governments guaranteeing that deforestation rates had increased across an entire country, that is generally an unacceptable level of risk for the private sector, and it doesn't make attractive investment for them. So the subnational approach is very much linked up to the idea that people want RED to be a carbon trading mechanism and to be funded through carbon offsets, which is something that ACRI Caucus is entirely against. We don't think RED should be an excuse for developed countries to continue polluting.
On the issue of funding then, where should the funds come from? I think we're talking about a lot of money. Perhaps you can fill us in on the rough amounts, but I think when I spoke to Bill Barclay, his preferred option was, I don't know, was a levy on emissions rights.
Yeah, there are a lot of different proposals on the table for where funds could come from if they didn't come from markets. There's also a lot of different estimates on the table for how much it would cost to reduce and halt deforestation. There are no reliable figures for how much it would cost to reduce and halt deforestation. They tend to be based on assumptions of opportunity cost and who you would need to pay to do this. In terms of where the funds could come from if they didn't come from markets, as you just mentioned, as Bill said, there's a proposal from Norway for auctioning of AAUs. AAUs are the permits that Annex 1 or developed countries get, which says how much CO2 they can emit under their binding agreements under Kyoto. At the moment, they get allocated these for free, and the idea is that they're slightly less than their previous emission levels so that they're forced to make a reduction. It's proposed that in the second commitment period, they have to pay for at least a proportion of those AAUs, which could raise over $30 billion a year for auctioning only 5 to 10% of AAUs. So clearly there's a lot more funds to be gained if we had an agreement to pay for a vast majority of our rights to pollute. There are other proposals on the table, such as taxes on bunker fuels, and that's shipping, and aviation, air travel passenger taxes. And again, they're estimated to raise between 20 to 30 billion a year. So there are many proposals on the table for how the funds could be raised. And the advocates of markets tend to say, well, this money has to be split between adaptation funding and RED and different funding areas, so we don't know that we'll get enough money. Developing countries have always stressed that they want adequate, predictable, and sustainable financial resources. But the question nobody asks is there is no proof that markets are going to generate adequate, predictable, or sustainable financial resources. And I think what we've seen of the markets in general over the last 12 months and the carbon market is that the levels of funding fluctuate wildly and have crashed recently. There's no guarantee that a market mechanism will generate the funds that are expected for forests.
Another issue that we've raised before is the need for demand-side measures. Basically, the rich countries' need for various goods and services that drive the demand for forest destruction, including such things as biofuels and meat and dairy-intensive diets and what have you, paper, I guess, and pulp. And hardwoods. It seems to me that RED won't work unless you're attacking both the demand and the supply side. So can you say what's currently in the text in this regard?
No, that's exactly right. And earlier on when I was talking about the problems of subnational and national approaches and how national approaches can deal with the issue of leakage within a country, I mentioned international leakage. The only way to deal with international leakage, and that's deforestation being stopped effectively in one country or reduced in one country, but simply moving to another country where these policies aren't being implemented. The only way to deal with that is to tackle the demand for forest and timber and agricultural products which drive deforestation. Most of that demand originates in the north and in the richer countries. Throughout the debates and the past year of negotiations on RED, there's been a lot of NGOs and some countries. Tuvalu have always been a really strong champion of demand-side measures and have always underlined that without addressing international leakage and closing the loop on the pressures on forests, we can never globally reduce deforestation and RED can't contribute to climate change mitigation. So there's always been a lot of champions of getting demand-side measures into the text. At the moment, all we have in this almost final text is encouraging all parties to find effective ways to reduce the pressure on forests. That's in the preamble, so it's not binding, and it's very, very unclear language. The argument that a lot of countries use against including anything on demand-side measures in the text, and the EU have used this argument recently, is that it would contravene WTO trade rules, and this is not a trade agreement, and we can't put anything in here that references to trade rules. Australian, surprisingly enough, Green Party politician recently pointed out that the United Nations is a body which is in authority over the WTO, although it doesn't really work that way. But in a UN text, there should be no reason not to put in language that contravenes WTO rules, and there are requirements for the WTO to not have rules that contravene or weaken environmental requirements in other legal areas. So it's essentially a non-starter of an argument, but it's been used effectively to keep any binding or useful language on demand-side drivers out of the text.
Okay. So we've got maybe 24 hours, maybe 36 hours to go, and this moves on to the ministers shortly, on the heads of state. What's hope for a decent agreement on deforestation here, bearing in mind that a lot of the last-minute talks are done on basis of horse trading, which doesn't really seem to guarantee the best results?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the time for negotiating and talks has run very, very short now. The RED working group who have been working on this text have just met for what they hope is the final time. And they made very few, in fact, no significant changes on the three key issues I mentioned of the global target for deforestation, monitoring and reporting on safeguards to make them something that are implementable, and solving the national versus subnational problem. So these outstanding issues in the text are now presented to the LCA plenary, which is starting quite soon tonight. The LCA chair will then need to decide if this text is finalised enough, or the parties between them recommend and decide if this text is finalised enough and ready to go to the ministerial level tomorrow. And then it's the ministers tomorrow who need to resolve these issues. As you said, with the horse trading approach, we may get one issue resolved and not the other, but basically unless all three key issues are cleared up in the text, there's not enough of a strong framework here to ensure that over the next few years we can get into place anything that will make RED be useful on the ground rather than a complete disaster and damaging. There's a huge risk that RED won't respect Indigenous people's rights, that carbon markets are not even really being decided here, whether the final phase of RED will be funded through that or not. That's a huge risk. So I personally hold out little hope that we'll get an extremely good RED agreement, but you have to bear in mind there has been a lot more progress on this RED text in a good direction than many people expected. The final thing to say, really, is that we have to see RED in the overall context that we're trying to get a global binding climate change treaty out of Copenhagen. RED is just one element of that among many elements, and what's really important here is that we get 40% binding targets for developed country reductions in their emissions, as well as commitments of finance and support for developing countries to adapt to climate change and to mitigate what they need to do. A RED agreement on its own, without being in the context of a wider and acceptable climate change package, is not something that we want to see. So we'd like to see movement in RED to improve the text, because RED's fairly inevitable now. But we'd also like to see the RED decision held off and put in the place of what really matters here in Copenhagen, and that's that industrial countries commit to reducing their emissions and commit to paying their historical debt for climate change impacts that are happening elsewhere around the world.
That was Kate Dooley from Fern, and also representing the Accra Caucus. Next up, we've got Frederica Whitehead's follow-up piece on the Clean Development Mechanism and what's going down there. We're seeing corporate lobbyists pushing for various forced solutions into an expanded clean development mechanism, and a lot of horse trading going on, which isn't good.
I am Alexander, founder of CompareTheMeerkat.com, where we compare meerkats. Size hobbies, you know, but lately we get many people looking for car insurance. For Compare Meerkats, come to CompareTheMeerkat.com. For easy way to save on car insurance, please go to CompareTheMarket.com. Simples. Cheap car insurance, meerkats. Two very different things. Listen there, jingle. CompareTheMarket.com. Listen mine.
CompareTheMeerkat.com.
Don't even sound same. CompareTheMeerkat.com, CompareTheMarket.com. Simples.
If you've watched television in the UK in the last year, that advert is probably familiar. What you maybe aren't so familiar with is CompareTheCarbonPrices.com. Okay, that's not actually the web address. The real address is cdmbazaar.net, and on this website you can compare the prices of carbon offsetting projects around the world. Trading on the carbon market is estimated to be worth 300 billion euros a year. To sell their carbon offsets on this market, projects need to register with the UNFCCC. The treaty negotiations that went on through the night last night, through the night before, and will probably go on through the night tonight as well, include a discussion of what new technologies can be listed on this market. This is highly controversial. Technologies such as nuclear power, coal-fired power with carbon capture and storage, and some techniques that are unfamiliar and barely understandable from the language in the text, and some that scientists say are unproven and may not actually reduce carbon emissions, are up for discussion and could be included within this text. These include things such as soil carbon sequestration, enhancing removals, or soil carbon management in agriculture. Leaving aside the unravelling of those terms for a moment, let's look at cdmbazaar.net. It's a very simple website to use. It's one click away from the UNFCCC website. And effectively, I mean, it just says buyers, sellers, service providers. And effectively, it's like using any other shopping website, except you're buying the rights to pollute. You're a big company in the West and you're buying the rights to pollute. So I'm buying into a small developing world project such as on this one, CDM. I've clicked on the CDM project ideas. I've clicked on CDM project ideas. First one out of the bag, Jatropha. Highly controversial. It's been accused that people are planting Jatropha and they're not planting enough food crops. It's biofuel project in West Kalimantan, Indonesia. And it says here, I've opened up the further information. Expected amount of annual CER reductions, metric tonnes, CO2 equivalent per annum, compared to the business as usual scenario, 1 million. Okay, so you can buy 1 million CERs from, let's see, the company, further information on the company. Ah, this is dedicated to the polar bear. How sweet. Because the polar bear cannot wait. Reasons for shopping with this seller, this nursery to plantation project. 2 years we have been propagating Jatropha in West Kalimantan. Now we have another nursery in Sangau Ledo. All our seedlings are growing healthily. Reasons to buy from us. Locality is optimal, land is redundant and almost free. I think a lot of people find that quite controversial. Manpower is the cheapest in Southeast Asia and supply is ample. Many are living below the poverty line. Okay, road and transportation is improving, local government is stabilising, and local authorities and her people welcome foreign investment. Okay, I think we've probably seen enough of this. Let's go to our next guest. I'm Frederica Whitehead. This is Climate Radio on Resonance FM, and I'm following up on a story that we broadcast on Tuesday. In Tuesday's programme, we talked about the Clean Development Mechanism, which is under negotiation here in Copenhagen. I'm here with Payel Parekh from the highly respected US watchdog International Rivers, and with Eva Filsmoser from CDM Watch. At that point, Payel, you were fairly confident about the way things were going, and it did look quite possible that nuclear and carbon capture and storage projects would not be included within the Clean Development Mechanism. So what I'm really interested in is how things have progressed and how the negotiations have been since I spoke to you on Monday.
Thanks for having me back on the program. In terms of nuclear, we're still very hopeful that this will continue to be prohibited under the CDM. But in terms of carbon capture and storage, or CCS, it's a completely different ball game. We know that the European Union is very keen on having CCS, and Brazil has been a country that has been very strong in opposing the inclusion of CCS. But unfortunately, Brazil would like to allow essentially plantations to be credited under the CDM. And so our worry is that there may be some horse trading going on between the EU and Brazil so that each gets what they want. And as we know now, ministers have arrived, heads of states are arriving. If this decision actually goes up the chain, this could be very, very risky and would undermine further the environmental integrity of the CDM.
Okay, Eva, do you want to come in there and give your point of view on that?
Yes, thanks, Frederica. I completely agree that what Payel pointed out to be the biggest issues in the CDM reform in terms of impact on environmental integrity. But in addition to the carbon capture and storage, nuclear, and this new proposal of Brazil to credit forest tree plantations, there's also another couple of contentious issues on the table which will influence the final outcome, because basically what will be the result will heavily depend on the compromises achieved by different parties involved, not only the EU and Brazil, but this will also be important for China, Japan, Saudi Arabia. They all have interests in this game. So we are very hopeful that the directions will go in the right direction, but there can be last-minute changes. We keep posted and we follow discussions closely. On a different issue, there is also worth mentioning that the issue of governance was on the agenda, and we were pushing very hard to strengthen the participation of civil society, which we believe is one of the fundamental issues of the CDM and has been the fundamental flaw so far. And there is some improvements. Unfortunately, the specification of what a conflict of interest is did not come through and was dropped. We're very sorry about this, but keep fighting.
Can you tell me what the progress are? We are now at Thursday. It's Thursday lunchtime. Negotiations were scheduled to end midnight Friday. Now looks like they probably won't. Do you have any idea what the next 48 hours might hold?
I think the next 40 hours or so is going to be very hard to predict. As we've seen the past couple days, sessions that were supposed to end at 9 or 10 o'clock at night went on until 6 or 7 in the morning. My understanding is that a similar situation happened during the negotiations in Bali, of course at Kyoto. So all we can say is the negotiations are very fluid and dynamic right now, and it's anyone's guess as to what's going to be on the table at the end of the day. It ain't over till the fat lady sings.
Thank you. That was Payal Parekh from International Rivers and Eva Filsmosa from CDM Watch. And maybe I'll speak to you again when we get any further news. Thanks a lot.
Before I go to my next interview, listeners should be aware that the Clean Development Mechanism itself came about as the result of a last-minute intervention at the Kyoto negotiations. Some policy wonks even refer to it as the Kyoto surprise. It's amazing to think that something with such a massive effect can be pulled out of the bag and find its way into a treaty in such a short time. And this might go some way to explaining why these meetings are so tense. There is a keen awareness that if you take your eye off the ball, or rather the many balls that are currently in the air, something entirely new can appear out of nowhere that will change everything. Bearing this in mind, I went to speak to Deepak Rugani. Deepak represents Biofuel Watch and the Global Forest Coalition, and he has been shouting his concerns about the CDM from the rooftops. I wanted to know what's being negotiated that he thinks could cause us problems in the future. Deepak, you have been following the negotiations very closely. For the benefit of listeners who aren't familiar with the ins and outs of the mechanism, what technologies are being considered that your organisation have concern about? What might get into it that you're worried about?
Yes, it's a good question. Well, first of all, let's recognise that the CDM is a deeply dysfunctional part of the Kyoto Protocol. It's a way in which the Global North sidestep their responsibility of reducing emissions at home and essentially prevent social change. So what we're seeing in the developing South is, of course, all sorts of suggestions, all sorts of propositions for cutting down or absorbing atmospheric CO2. Now, industry is promoting a number of ways of doing this. There's the same old stuff on the table, like coal with carbon capture and storage, but there's also new stuff. There's a number of unproven technologies which use soils and which use agriculture and use forests as a way of absorbing or sequestering atmospheric CO2.
Okay, and in layman's terms, that would be biochar and biofuels.
That's exactly the sort of thing we're talking about. Biofuels, biochar. We're also talking about another method called no-till GM crops, which is a way of putting the seed into the ground without having to till it, and then using large-scale herbicide like Roundup as a way of keeping other competing species out. Of course, this has major problems in terms of accumulation of toxins in the water and up the food chain, but there's also problems in terms of the fact that actually we're not necessarily absorbing atmospheric CO2 into the soil. There's no evidence to show that's really happening.
I think the idea of soil being the relationship between carbon and soil is one that a lot of members of the public don't know about or don't understand. I think it's quite a thing, really. Can you explain that in layman's terms?
Yes. Well, land that's been untouched for millions of years, as much land is untouched in Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, contains vast amounts of carbon because the photosynthesis happening with the plants above the ground has been depositing it in the soils. So when land is cleared and the land is tilled, the oxidation of that of those soils releases vast quantities of CO2. Now, what scientists are saying is that we can actually use technology like biochar, which is essentially charcoal, and deposit it in the soil and actually increase or improve on nature by increasing the amount of carbon that whole soil holds. There's no long-term evidence that this is true except for in one situation, which is the Terra Preta in the Amazonian regions, and that's never been replicated elsewhere in the world. If I move to no-till GM crops now, as an example, the upfront emissions from land clearance would take centuries for any GM crops to actually reabsorb that carbon, and there's no evidence that it really does so anyway.
If these new technologies were to make it into the final text, what would the implications be, in your opinion?
Well, they'd be pretty dire. We're talking about here a gigantuan land grab like we've never seen before. It's the equivalent of converting the global south to monocultures in the way we've done with the global north. As far as no-till GM crops are concerned, that would become the favoured way of growing food. It would be like a second green revolution, so they say. And we will displace millions of small farmers who are actually doing the right stuff, retaining carbon in soils. As far as biochar is concerned, well, it depends if biochar is used as a geoengineering solution to climate change, which is really how it's being advocated. If that really was the case, we'd be looking at the sort of land area of perhaps 500 million hectares. Now, that's 1.5 times the entire land area of India. If we did that kind of experiment, not only do we have a vast upfront carbon debt as we convert the land and release carbon from the soils and remove the above-ground biomass, it would take centuries to actually break even as far as that's concerned. So we end up with a vast emission slug accelerating climate change. We also lose key ecosystems. And ecosystems are essential. They don't just support a stabilised climate. They also are major contributors to other life support systems, including our rainfall cycle.
I've just managed to track down Teresa Anderson from the African Biodiversity Network. Teresa, I'm very interested to hear your point of view on the current CDM negotiations and the relationship, what's going on in Africa on the ground in terms of biochar, biofuels and...
Okay, well, to put it into context and give a bit of history about the process, in previous negotiations for the UNFCCC, the CDM... parties at the CDM have approved certain approaches which can be included under the CDM. So these include either forestry systems or they can include reducing emissions from industrial processes. Now there's debate over whether new issues can come in, so such as nuclear, carbon capture and storage, and the other issue is whether agriculture can be included under the CDM. And biochar would be one of the main methodologies that would come in if soil carbon management in agriculture was included under the CDM. Now, some people might say that we can trust the CDM, they have a process to decide which methodologies are sensible or not. But as you probably know, a few years ago, biofuels came through as being touted as a huge new solution to climate change. And then all this information emerged about how actually it was leading to land grabbing, led to greater emissions, led to food crisis, deforestation, etc., etc. Now, in spite of all that we know now about biofuels and have known now for a few years, only 6 weeks ago, the CDM board, which is separate from this whole process of negotiations between parties, the CDM board decided that a biofuels methodology could be approved under the CDM. And this was a big shock, and I think it would be a big shock to many African parties who were aware of the land grabbing that's already taking place from biofuels. I think many people would be shocked that the CDM board feels unaccountable enough to be able to go ahead and make these decisions when we know all the problems there are with biofuels. So this is why we're very concerned about the impact of if soil carbon management in agriculture gets approved as a CDM methodology, then biochar would be the main methodology that could come through that. And that would, again, lead to serious impacts on land grabbing. The proponents are talking about between 500 million and 1 billion hectares of land being used for tree plantations for biochar production, and they expect most of that land to come from Africa. The potential implications of a CDM system subsidising this massive land grab, basically in order to resolve a climate change, would be a complete disaster for land rights issues, for indigenous people, for food production and for forests in Africa. The thing is, the lines are so blurry and it's all really confusing about what the problems are with this language. I mean, the language sounds so nice about, you know, soil carbon sequestration. Surely that would encourage the right kind of organic farming. But what a lot of people don't realise, and what a lot of people who might have exactly the same objectives as myself, to encourage small-scale organic agriculture, biodiversity, is if you take this language and put it into market contexts such as the CDM or RED or any other UNFCCC offset system that might be proposed, is you end up when you apply market forces to these things, the socioeconomic and environmental benefits just don't come through, and it's always the large scale, big industrial projects that benefit. So if you want to support soil carbon sequestration through organic farming, the last thing you need to do is to put it into the CDM, because what will happen is that GM crops and biochar are the big guys. They can participate and benefit from the CDM, but the small-scale organic farmer is not going to have a clue about the existence of the CDM, let alone how to participate. And it's such a technologically demanding process to participate in. It's really also financially demanding, that you have to be a big organization to be able to take part. And so it's just completely irrelevant. It's on another planet, basically, from small-scale organic farming. And so it would be, there are some, unfortunately, there are some amazing organic farming groups who are hoping that recognition of soil carbon sequestration or such things in the CDM would support organic agriculture. But I think it's actually a bit dangerous. You know, it would be a massive own goal if instead this led to GM crops. We'll be right back.
instant coffee, porn, reality TV, not tires, paper diapers, Mohammed B, not A no further than the corner guarantee.
Next up, we've got an interview with some activists that were detained by the police earlier in the week, and this is Tom Besley reporting.
Okay, I'm standing in a bar outside Central Station with
Johnny
and Michael.
Johnny and Michael, thanks for talking to us. So you were involved, you were involved in a different protest yesterday. What happened?
We were lifted by 7:30 this morning on the train. The police spotted us, and we had ropes around us and quite a lot of gear actually, like wire cars and stuff. But anyway, so we ended up in the cells by 8 o'clock. Well, because everyone was such high energy and a lot of people got lifted really early, it all kicked off. We broke down a couple of the cell walls.
Were these the cages heard about?
Okay. Very Glendano Baysdale, and you...
It was just a warehouse of cells, so like... I know there's meant to be 1,500 in it, but you could only see so much of the cells. I don't think it was that much. But just because everyone was so riled up, there was a lot of chanting, a lot of bashing against the cages.
And people were quite often making like animal noises. But there was, we had people within the group that were clowns that had been arrested, and they were trying to do clowning inside. There were people doing yoga inside. We rolled our socks into balls and started playing games with them, like football and volleyball and things, and there was just a kind of spirit of we are not caged animals, and it led to these things like us ripping whereby
we worked out if you get enough people on the dividing cages between the cells, you can lift it up and bend it out of the cage and then get everybody into one cell. So we the first time we did this, it's great because it just cheering goes up around the place, like everyone's going mental on the other side of the place, they know we've got a cage up, but just like 100, well, I don't know, about 40 cops just filled the corridor.
And then they start pepper spraying, and it's really, really vicious stuff, and when everyone is on the ground and at the back, they start to come in with the truncheons, and they just... We linked arms, but they just beat us until and pressure pointed us until they could get one person out, and then they'd come in again and do the same and get another person out and one by one and put us in another set of cells, and then finally when they'd gone away and enough chanting and energy built up again, we'd do the same thing, and then they'd do it again and they'd come in and beat us up and drag us away, and then eventually we got zip ties put on in the cages. Behind our backs, and then we started undoing, we came up with a way of undoing the zip ties, and they came in, and then dead people zip ties people's hands behind their back and then zip tied it to their belt buckles.
I think it was important to keep up some sort of fight, as you know, we got lifted at fucking 7:30 in the morning. A lot of the bike people were lifted well early as well. Is if we can't do shit outside, then we'll bounce things up in here. The level of repression is just absolutely unreal. Like, the arresting people for having done nothing, we're on the way to the protest. They can hold you for 12 hours. Like, it's just a complete lack of human rights. So it was important to, well, A, take out as much police time as we could with damaging yourselves, but also show that we're not going to just sit back and not fight.
Some of the people that had been targeted were medics. We had a friend who is a medic who had been arrested 3 times during the week and had been in these cages before and was just so frustrated. And someone had been beaten by the police and had got a nasty head injury. And they were being treated by a medic. And
Were you being treated by police medics or by medics who had been arrested? This was at a protest outside.
When he was just as he was about to get lifted, and they were treating this person, and the police came in, and although they were going to take them to hospital, the police just arrested them, and this person was feeling quite sick, and after a bad head injury, that's his usual sign of severe concussion, and the police were leaving this person in a cage where they could have like fallen into a coma. It's really, really nasty.
So were you receiving any treatment yourselves?
There wasn't folk that were bashing off by the police. Like, basically they pepper sprayed us into submission and then grabbed folk, like pressure point of being a bit, but there wasn't anything in the cells that was enough to warrant need a medic apart from like eyes. But I mean, they just, you know, when it's in close range with pepper spray, it's got radius like 4 meters. Get one in your face, you just got absolutely no chance. So, you know, we're just having to back against the cage, and then they separated us and tied us up with zip ties in the end.
What about food and water? And like, were you allowed to go to toilets, things like this?
Not when we were kicking off, like, you weren't allowed to anything then. Yeah. Just got food about after about 10 or 11 hours.
What were they giving you?
I'm vegan, so I could only get an apple and a pear because the rest of the food has meat or dairy products in it.
Yeah. And did they only let you have one apple and one pear? Could you have as much as you needed?
No, that was it. Like,
but it was quite funny how when everyone was offered food, then the behaviour suddenly stepped up and everyone was well behaved. But before that, everyone is just so tense and so angry.
And what's the outcome now? Does this leave you with like a record, or was it detention and then you're released?
No, it was just detainment, like, but I think everybody was in the cells. I reckon today's come out feeling empowered in a different way. Like, it was incredible solidarity there, despite having been oppressed and put in these cells. Compared to maybe some people that were on the march and felt disempowered because that didn't achieve anything. First of all, learn a lot, but that we're kind of stronger out of this and that we just need to find a different way to change things in our own terms rather than trying to change things onto these oppressed times. Like,
based on your experience of police action, are you going to carry on taking direct action against the police, or is this going to change the way that you approach protest?
No, I think direct action is important. It's the best way we can have to actually change things, to make the changes ourselves. And the police, as Michael said earlier, is just an arm of the state. It's just the visible aspect of the oppression that we see. So we have to keep working for better ways to, you know, combat this. But at the same time, it is important to change how we are, how we operate in our you know, culture, and how we change things societally. So if we behave in the way we want things to be, as well as fighting this oppression on a direct action level, I think they will benefit each other.
That's about it from Copenhagen Daily here at the Bella Centre, and we'll be probably up all night trying to follow the twists and turns of the conference. And we'll be bringing you our wrap-up of that tomorrow. I think it's going to be a last show rather than show on Sunday. It kind of depends on the schedule of everything here. But it has been a series of mad late nights for the negotiators already. There's a long way to go. So do tune in tomorrow for our final assessment and report. And if you've missed any of these shows, you can always go to the Climate Radio Archive and find them there. The web address is www.climateradio.org. Thanks very much for listening. To Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.